Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. We have a special episode today. We are talking to General Mike Hayden, who has a new book out called The Assault on Intelligence. You are a fairly regular presence on the various cable news networks and so forth, and many of our listeners will remember your public presence from the George W. Bush administration.
Right.
Now, make sure I have I guess you were NSA.
I was NSA as a Clinton appointee.
Right.
Carried on by President Bush. President Bush then asked me to be the first principal deputy director of national intelligence, which I did for about a year.
And that's part of the post 9/11 reform
of the intelligence community. So I was actually the first one in that position. And then he asked me to go from there after about a year to CIA, where I served for the remainder of his term. And then President Obama asked me to stay on. And I stayed for about 3 weeks while we were waiting for Leon Panetta to be confirmed.
Right. So here we're going to talk about the book, and we're going to talk about the sort of the elephant in the room for everything that is happening right now. One thing I want to mention is I want to share a word from our sponsor. Still need a Father's Day gift? Hand the man a cold brew. Give Pops the ultimate summer surprise with a subscription to Grady's Cold Brew. He gets 36 cups of New Orleans-style iced coffee delivered directly to his door. The cold brew kit includes everything he will need to create a smooth, velvety cold brew at home. Just add water. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 20% off your first order at Grady'sColdBrew.com. That's Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. Or order Grady's on Amazon.com for next day delivery. So the first thing I want to ask is this. You are a career Air Force, military. That's where that's your intelligence background. Tell us, and I'm remembering from the book, I think you received your commission in 67 or 69?
Commissioned 67, actually entered active duty in 69. The Air Force let me go 2 more years to graduate school.
Got it. Okay. What does, I think at least many people think they, whether they really do have an idea is one thing, but think they know what, you know, kind of someone who's an Army general or admiral kind of has done through their decades of service. Career in military intelligence.
Sure.
What is the job?
So there's great variety in the job. So the first thing I did was go to a technical school to just learn some skills. And you have to keep in mind that's 69. It's the height of the Vietnam War. And although I wasn't assigned to Vietnam, we learned the skills there that one would need to support that kind of war effort. I then went to Omaha. Strategic Air Command headquarters at the time, which was really a blessing because that had a global mission. So for an intelligence officer to have the widest possible field of view was a real advantage. I went from there to Guam, again, still during the war. And so there I supported B-52 operations out of Guam against Southeast Asia. Got out of the lane a bit coming home, became an ROTC instructor for 4 years in Vermont. Back into intelligence, a little more training, to Korea at a tactical fighter wing. I came back to the United States and did some what we call professional military education. The Department of Defense is actually quite good at trying to make sure its officers are as well developed as possible. And then I entered into attaché and language training to be the air attaché to the People's Republic of Bulgaria during the communist period, which was I still describe as my second best job ever.
Okay. How long were you there?
I was there with 2 years.
Okay.
2 years. And we were really enjoying it, but we had children, and there are lots of stresses and strains on their education and so on. So we came back after two. Came back, served at Air Force headquarters for an extended period of time, was selected to go over and work on George H.W. Bush's NSC staff, back to the Pentagon to support the Secretary of the Air Force. And these aren't intelligence jobs, so I've gotten a mix of things here. And then I got promoted to Brigadier General, one star, picked up again to do intelligence work, and I became the head of intelligence for American forces in Europe. And Josh, you know, sometimes the magic works, sometimes it doesn't. So I go to Europe in 1993, and what's the war du jour? The Balkans,
right.
Yugoslavia. I speak Bulgarian. I've lived in the Balkans. I can apply right background
right place,
to the
right
task.
Time. Yeah.
From there, back to the States after 3 years, to Texas, from Texas to Korea again. And then in Korea, I get invited back to interview for the director of NSA job. And George Tenet was the head of intelligence then. George selected me. And then we pick up the story where we began it, from NSA to DNI to CIA. So, you know, if you ask me what I did, I'm an intel guy.
Right.
But I had a lot of policy jobs, and I had the instructor job, too.
Now, two questions on that. So Texas, that's the I can't remember the exact name, but that's the Air Force Intelligence
Agency.
It is. Agency,
I was commander of what was called then the Air Intelligence Agency. That's right.
Now, this may seem like a random question, but wasn't there there was that Cold War incident where wasn't it I'm not sure if it was a Bulgarian emigre in London who was assassinated, the umbrella. Were you in that era? Were you there?
No,
I was
a little behind that era. That happened before I got there, but it sure did make you pay attention to your security while you were in Bulgaria. Actually, you had that incident, and you also had the Bulgarian who attempted to assassinate the Pope.
Right.
And that actually took place right before we went to the Balkans. And it's pretty clear that the Bulgarian service did have a hand in that.
Yeah. Now, was that assassination in London, was that the Bulgarian?
It was done by the Bulgarians against a Bulgarian who had then taken up an emigre, someone who left communist Bulgaria, and then became a fairly active in broadcasting back to Bulgaria in native Bulgarian, things the Bulgarian government didn't want the people to hear.
Right.
Yeah, but again, in broad daylight, a poison tip of an umbrella poked into somebody crossing as a pedestrian on a bridge in London. Yeah.
Now that was the Bulgarian, you know, spy, whatever you want to, secret police, particularly aggressive for the other Warsaw Pact countries?
Yeah, they did. They did have a reputation. The service was called Državna Sigurnost, State Security, obviously mentored by the KGB. And for reasons that I don't mean to use to accuse the Bulgarians were often described as the 16th Republic of the Soviet Union. All right, so among the Warsaw Pact satellites, it had a reputation for being the most loyal to the Soviets. Now, again, I didn't want to be accusatory because there are powerful reasons in Bulgarian history.
It's like Pan-Slav
A Pan-Slav aspect to it, but they both use roughly the same alphabet. They both use Cyrillic. In fact, the Bulgarians will tell you Kirill and Methodius invented the alphabet for them, and then they exported it to the Russians. You do have Orthodoxy as the religion, and the Russians liberated the Bulgarians not once but twice. They liberated them in the 19th century from the Turks and liberated them from the Nazis in the 20th century. So there is a sense of affinity, all right, that is historically grounded. But from my point of view, it just made them a tough, loyal service, and one need be careful.
Right, right. So here's another question I wanted to ask you. I should know this number. Are there 17 intelligence agencies in
the community is comprised of, depending on how you count, 16 or 17.
Okay.
And the wild card is whether or not you count the DNI itself as one
Got
of the
it.
Agencies.
Got it. Yeah. So here's my question. I think probably most of our listeners will have a sense that there's a certain bureaucratic element. Everybody
sure.
kind of wants their own agency and so forth. But in a military context,
right.
So each of the services, I believe, have their own agencies, and then there's the DIA. What for the Air Force?
Sure.
Why is there an Air Force intelligence agency?
So it's complicated, all right. And so what you have inside each of the services, all right, are intelligence activities that, by and large, retail intelligence. All right. So what you've got are people in the Air Force who present intelligence to the Air Force. I'm being binary here, and life is never binary, but I think that's a fair description. Mm-hmm. So what it is they do is make sure the Air Force can use intelligence created by others. All right.
Okay.
So they're not fundamentally the creators of the information. They are the appliers of the information.
So they're drawing a lot of that from the other agencies.
From the big agencies.
Got it.
From the,
okay.
And
okay.
So if I did this on a chart in front of us, all right, I'd have three layers, and the services would be down there at the bottom layer, all right? And there are five, all right, because you throw the Coast Guard in there as well,
mm-hmm.
all right? But at the very top layer, you've got six, and those are the big, fairly well-known, muscular, national collection agencies.
Got it, okay.
NSA collects via signals, CIA, human beings, NGA, imagery, and so on.
Okay, I didn't.
Yeah, so it sounds like we have too many men on the field. We should be permanently penalized 5 yards. but there is a logic to it. Again,
right.
the best way of thinking of it is the folks down there in the services are retailers. Your wholesale production elements are up here at the top.
Got it. Okay. So into the first decade of this century, now, were you still in uniform when you were at
yes.
the CIA?
I actually did. You know, and that was a choice. And the president and I talked about it. Actually, he talked to me about it. in essence, saying, Mike, there are some people who are uncomfortable with your staying in uniform. I'm not going to tell you not to do it, but we may have to come back to you.
Got
and my
it.
Answer was, Mr. President, there are personal reasons why I would want to stay in uniform. But if need be, I will leave. And it turned out I didn't have to.
Got it. Okay.
And now, I did retire from the Air Force about 7 or 8 months before I left CIA. So my last half a year there, I was
civilian. Got it. Okay. So in the Bush era at NSA and CIA, you were, you know, a public – I mean, you may not have seen yourself as a political figure, but you were part of the politics of that era and stuff.
So
what was that like?
Yeah. So I'd probably use slightly different words, but there's no question that I felt I needed to have a bit of a public profile, all right? And I actually began that at NSA, actually in the Clinton years.
Mm-hmm. And that's 99
you 99,
okay.
exactly. So I'm almost 3 years there before President Bush comes on board. And the thought was that we were doing a lot of things, and some of them would probably trouble some Americans. And so it was probably better for us to go out there and put a human face on ourselves and, to the degree possible, mm-hmm. explain
right.
what it was we were doing. The phrase I used was put a human face on our agency. Another phrase I used with my folks was, you know, if we don't say something about ourselves, the first bad news story about us will act like gas in a vacuum. It'll fill up the whole space.
Right, right.
And so we consciously went out. And Josh, there was a subplot here that was really important. This is an NSA, all right? We really didn't have many civil liberties concerns, and no one really barked at us about it when we were intercepting Soviet strategic rocket forces communications going from headquarters out to ICBM fields.
Mm-hmm.
And the phrase I use, looking for words of interest, like launch.
Right.
Okay? But the 21st century targets we were going at were not nation states with their own communication structures. They were terrorists, proliferators, and so on, using commonly available communication systems where your communications coexisted with theirs.
Right.
And so if you wanted us to do what it was we did for you then, now, you had a admit that we're going to be in a place where your stuff's going to be skitting by too.
Right, right.
And we didn't think the Americans would accept that, would give us their vote of legitimacy unless we made that more public. So we just consciously raised our profile.
Got it. I think before we started recording, I mentioned that I was also reading James Clapper's book, and he makes that point that in the Cold War you have basically two separate information systems and this stuff. Now, a lot of our listeners, you know, there's the stuff with Edward Snowden and before that, all the debates about warrantless surveillance and so forth before that happened. Do you look back and say, well, we could have done this differently, or we didn't need to do this, or what's your retrospective take on that?
So the retrospective, lessons learned, all right, no regrets, all right. At the time, I thought what we did was effective, lawful, and appropriate, and my position now is we were effective, lawful, and appropriate. But there were some things within the American political context that we should have done. One is that when we – and this is all post 9/11 stuff, all right? So we're responding to very different circumstances. And I like your point from Jim's book that they had their comms, we had ours, it was okay.
Right.
Well, what happened at 9/11 was it's not just that the comms were intermingled. It was our enemy was intermingled with us. I mean, we had a foreign-based attack on the United States that emanated from within the United States.
Right.
All right. And so we have a new challenge, and so we strapped on a bunch of things. And if you're interested in details, we can do that. But and again, I thought they were effective, lawful, and appropriate. But what we did, based upon the political direction of the administration, was to confine our briefing of those things to a very small body of people in the Congress. Now, that's perfectly legal. Mm-hmm. The Congress shall be kept fully and currently informed.
This is the group of eight.
Did exactly right. We, rather than brief all the committees and lay it all out, we briefed the gang of four, sometimes the gang of eight. I was the briefer. Trust me, I was as forthcoming as I could possibly be because I was going to be around when the political guys were gone.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And so was the agency.
Right.
All right. And so we were incentivized to just lay it all out there. And we did. But when they later become public, the information about the programs, the courage of the people we had briefed was fairly limited. And to be fair to them, we had put them in a very, very difficult position because we had briefed 8 out of 535. And there they were, you know, feeling like the settlers surrounded in hostile territory by everyone else. So the lesson learned there was, although it was important to keep it secret, we probably should have been more aggressive, briefing more people, not more fully. We did that fine.
Right.
We just didn't brief enough of them. So that's one. The second lesson learned was with regard to metadata, that's data about the call rather than the content of the call. That became a bit of a secret sauce for us. It was a very powerful tool. We probably should have been not just more informing of more members of Congress. We probably should have begun to show a bit of leg about that to the general public.
Got it.
Because when it finally comes out, it's to use a phrase, we could have inoculated a lot of people against it coming out the way it did by being more forthcoming earlier in a more public way. Now, that's not easy, all right? Mm-hmm. But in retrospect, we probably should have tried harder.
So one of the things you talk about in the book is, and correct me if I'm wrong, I believe this is when you're running the Air Force Intelligence Agency down in Texas. That, and this is in the 90s, so this is kind of when the internet is becoming a thing. And there's a debate about, you know, what are we trying to do?
Exactly.
Are we trying to do, and I'll try to explain for our listeners what I think you're describing. The difference between sort of a cyber approach is we're going to control the network infrastructure. We'll go where we want to go. We'll prevent other people versus information dominance.
Right.
Which is sort of like information operations and kind of what the Russians did.
Exactly.
Okay. So take it from there.
Yeah. So I'm down there in San Antonio, which is where this is. The Air Force is kind of on the cutting edge of the cyber thing.
Now, why is that? Tell us why that is.
Because the cyber domain looks more like air and space than it does land and sea.
Got it. Okay.
I mean, these are domains of conflict.
Right.
And the physics of cyber feel more like space and air than they do, all right? So it's a natural thing. All right. So we were there. I had a lot of bright thinkers. They sat me down and said, it's a domain, General, land, sea, air, space, cyber. It's a domain. We're going to go fight there. We're going to dominate there, just like we do in the other domains, because that's what the American people pay us to do.
Right.
Got it. But there was a theological debate. And I think I say in the book something with all the intensity of medieval Jesuits. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the debate was over, were we in the cyber business, which you just described, you know, we're working the network where we could go steal data, protect data, or whatever, or were we in the more broadly defined information business, for which cyber would have been a subset. All right. And so if you're in the information business, you're talking about deceptions, psychological operations, public diplomacy, perceptions, and so on. And so we had a pretty serious debate. And since America now has a cyber command, you can tell how this ended up.
Right.
We stayed over here in cyber. A couple reasons. One is cyber was hard enough. Okay. Information was incredibly complex. And you can't really work in the information dominant space very long without starting to bump your shins on the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, and other legal things, policy things, constitutional things, right, in the American system. So we, by and large, have become a cyber force. I tell the story in the book that the Russians went to door number two. The Russians went over to the information dominance door, and personified by the writings of the fellow who is now chief of the general staff, Valery Gerasimov, who wrote articles about contactless warfare, using informational weapons against the real target, an adversary's population. And frankly, they just followed that playbook quite closely, 2015 and 16, against the American election. And the problem, Josh, that presents for us as we respond to it, we don't have the doctrinal framework that compels us to think along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so in addition to figuring out how to counter, we actually have to embrace and learn more about what it is.
Right.
Because we don't do it.
So, okay. So one thing I was very struck about, you talk about this in the book, that we, you know, one of our things that our website has focused on for years and years and years is the sort of subterranean part of politics and conspiracy theories, right, and stuff like that. So when Jade Helm was happening in real time, we were all over that, and you know, this thing and that thing.
You were.
Big time. We did a lot on that. Well, the thing is that there was an article that was written in 2015, and you're probably familiar with it. It's by a guy named Adrian Chen in the New York Times Magazine. And he did this whole kind of expose on the Internet Research, or what I guess.
Internet Research Agency. Yep.
When they were, you know, they had some like hoaxes down, mm-hmm, in the Gulf, you know, right, our Gulf, you know, Gulf states. And just, you know, it really seemed like trying stuff out,
exactly,
without any particular angle.
Exactly.
And when I thought back, I was like, you know, the Jade Helm thing just seems so like that, because here's the thing: is that he writes this piece in 2015, and he sees these Twitter accounts talking about like Ebola, you know, mm-hmm, stoking all, right, these different things, and then about a year later, he's checking up on them again, and they've all refashioned themselves as like Trump supporter accounts. In any case, okay, so. One of the things you say in the book is that the actual, you know, cyber part of what happened, hacking into the DNC and stuff, is a relatively minor part of it.
Right.
So how do we – everybody's been hearing for 2 years now or a year and a half now about what the Russians did. But what is the conceptual framework, kind of,
sure,
what you're talking about, to what they
so,
did?
So we pick it up with Valery Gerasimov and informational weapons and so on. So the first population that the Russians bubble is their own, all right? And that's a question of political control, and they're actually quite good at it. And then they begin to experiment with it in what they call the near abroad. And so you've got a Russian informational bubble over their occupation and annexation of the Crimea. All right. If you recall back in the day, the little green men, mm-hmm. no patches, balaclavas, who are those guys? And I mean, obviously, it becomes clear fairly quickly. But in the meantime, it's just not quite as binary as you would need to generate immediate political action on the part of countries that would object changing borders by force in Europe.
Right.
And so under this kind of informational bubble, the Russians get to do what they do in the Crimea, and it's a fait accompli. We see the height of their art form after their surrogates and probably some Russian professionals shoot down a Malaysian airliner over the Ukraine. And they use this informational assault to cloud the issue so darkly that a lot of good people just put up their hands and say, well, you know, we'll probably never know. I mean, I looked at it and said, well, I know what happened. This is pretty obvious.
Right.
And in fact, in the last week or two, a European Commission has said,
here's what
happened.
Right.
But in the meantime, the Russians obfuscate this so much that almost all of their own population believes that the Ukrainians shut it down. And a lot of Europeans are throwing up their hands saying, well, you know, it's really complex, cloud of war, fog, who knows.
Right.
And then with those kinds of successes, you're right. In 14 and 15, they take the show on the road into the United States. There are some isolated instances, but Jade Helm becomes kind of the core test.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's really important to recognize that in Jade Helm, they had the help, I'm not saying collusion or planning.
Right.
But they had a common effort that was being undertaken by alt-right media in the United States.
Like people like Alex Jones,
InfoWars, yeah. Gateway Pundit, and so on. Mm-hmm. And they are pushing the Jade Helm narrative too. And very briefly for your listeners, the Jade Helm narrative was that a very vanilla special forces exercise in Texas and some other states was actually an attempt by the Obama administration to round up political opponents and put them in concentration camps. Sounds weird, but the combination of alt-right media, Russian bots, mm-hmm. created so much concern among some Texans that the governor actually called out something called the State Guard, which is a volunteer force.
So not like this, not like the National Guard.
Not quite the National Guard. But by the way, they're both under the Texas Military Department. So,
got it.
I mean, it's official.
It's a real thing.
Yeah. To go out and watch the feds so that he can report nothing, everything's okay.
He's got it under control if they try anything.
Don't be alarmed.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, the stories are abandoned Walmarts being used as concentration camps, boxcars transiting Texas with leg irons.
Oh, believe me, we were covering this at the time.
Do you guys have a sense of whether Alex Jones and the sort of conspiracy journalists got wind of it from the sort of bot accounts? I mean, you know.
It's, you know, I don't have to impute explicit cooperation. And so I generally use the word convergence rather than collusion. Mm-hmm. Okay? They're making common cause, each for their own purposes.
And it seems possible. Right. I mean, again, we have the American political psyche churns this stuff up with some regularity.
So that the Russians do not have to create stories. They have stories created in the American vernacular that will resonate with Americans, created by Americans.
Right.
They just pick them up. I'll give you one that I talk about at length in the book, Josh, is take a knee. All right? That's created by the president.
All right.
I mean, okay. It's Kaepernick's a little irritating, but
He captured it in a phrase.
He put it in front of a red hot Alabama crowd on a Friday night in September.
Right.
Before he gets back to the East Coast, the Russian bots are alive with it. The American alt-right media picks it up, goes pretty racial, mm-hmm. pretty fast, and then it bleeds over to Fox News, and then the first viewer sees Fox News on a weekday morning and tweets his support for it.
Right.
Okay, and you've got this circle, this cycle, which ends up dividing the American people. Now, they're not collusion. Everybody does it for their own purposes, the president, the base, the Russians to mess with our heads, the alt-right because they're conspiratorial, Fox, it feeds their demographic, it helps their ratings. But we end up with a much more divided nation, and I like to conclude that little vignette with, and this wasn't a national crisis. You know, they hadn't gotten into the bye weeks yet in the NFL.
Right.
So all 32 were suiting up
mm-hmm.
the previous Sunday. That was 1,750 athletes suited up for NFL football. A total of six did anything other than standard attention. A self-imposed wound, exploited by the Russians, by the alt-right, and we've become a more divided society because of it. And it continues to the day.
Let me ask you this. So, okay, one of the things you talk about in the book is during the first, there's the annexation of Crimea, and then you get this sort of like, you know, kind of low intensity conflict in the eastern
part
of
Ukraine. In the Donbass, right?
And there's always this kind of like everybody sort of knows that the Russians are involved, but it's a little hard to.
Yeah.
And so one thing you capture there is that all of this stuff happening at one time, and when you were just mentioned before about when during the annexation of Crimea, obviously. The U.S., NATO, any U.S. president is going to want to be really sure before they get into any sort of kinetic, you know, confrontation with Russia for all the obvious reasons. And if you're looking at it and you're like, whoa, did they really annex it? Or maybe there was just a referendum and stuff like that. You lose your sort of... you're wrong-footed because it's hard to figure out exactly what's going on. That seems, I think, to a lot of people, seems a lot of stuff that's happening in the U.S. right now.
Oh,
where like you know, you must have worked fairly closely over the years with Robert Mueller.
Absolutely.
And whatever else Mueller is, he's certainly not like a left-wing Democratic activist or something like that. And yet we're kind of talking about that.
Yes, we are.
So. What do we like?
It's look. I'm not accusing anyone currently in our government of being agent of the Russian Federation. All right, but the tactics, techniques, and procedures echo one another. It is fundamentally. There are two kind of major lines of effort here. All right, the first is very much like the Russian line of effort, which is I can make this so confusing that even good people throw up their hands. In other words. Josh, this is a very, really interesting dynamic. I mean, the purpose of free information is to create good thought that generates good action, all right? We've generally feared breaking that chain by suppressing free information, okay? That's not what's happening here. What's happening here is you're throwing so much information into the funnel that people become confused and therefore you break the link between reality and action by obfuscating what reality might actually be, not suppressing a particular description of reality. And that's one line of effort that the Russians use, and you're right, it's happening right now. The other line of effort that right now is more American than Russian is not arguing the facts of the case, but simply delegitimizing those whose facts you don't find particularly pleasant.
Right.
And so you just go after their validity to have these views at all.
Right. So now let me – okay. So I mentioned before that so you're still in uniform, but you're part of the – in a public sense, you're part of the Bush administration. And
yeah, I'm a political appointee confirmed by the Senate.
Right. Right. So – and then I think in 2015 – You actually spoke at CPAC? Is that do I have the
I
you?
Did.
Okay, right. So so I don't know exactly what you're but you're
it was an away game for a former director of NSA, right. Trust me.
Well, well, especially this is what is so I feel like we're living in this sort of like upside down universe where the public enemy on the right is the FBI, which is like that is, I mean.
How does this work?
Yeah, how does this work?
So I talk about this. You know, the old lines are all faded, all right? And now it's populism, all right, which has different origins and different thought patterns than the traditional, you know, liberal conservative divide in American life. And so what you get out of populism is kind of the Rand Paul libertarian. All states are bad and powerful states are really bad. And so when I actually went to CPAC, it was a debate between me and Andrew Napolitano, the judge from Fox News,
right?
And we're actually pretty good friends. But we went out there and, you know, pounded the table in his best libertarian fashion, right?
Right.
And so I go out. He leads off. He does 3 to 5. Now it's my turn.
Right.
Of course, it's a debate. And I begin by saying, my good friend Judge Napolitano is an unabashed libertarian.
Right.
Crowd goes crazy. And so am I. And boo, no, you're not. And I mean, it was really audience participation.
Right.
And I said, no, I am. But I am also responsible for another part of the document. You know, the part that says provide for the common defense. Mm-hmm. And then that was going to be my approach. But it was, it was definitely an away game.
Well, so I was thinking how that was, 2015 would be sort of the last pre-Trump Republican Party CPAC. And what has occurred to me, when in this book, you talk about Fox News as to a great extent. I mean, you have a part where you say about, the people who you think are solid journalists there.
Right. And I do a carve out.
Yeah, no, yeah, definitely, yeah. Definitely. But it leaves a lot of people out of that circle of trust. Tell me your experience of how the, because now I'd expect to see you on CNN or MSNBC more than Fox, right?
You haven't seen me on Fox for a couple years.
Right. Okay. So. And in the book, you talk about different like Never Trump figures. I know you're part of this organization that I think the committee to investigate.
Right. Rob Reiner's effort.
Right. Which again, in the world we're living in now, Brennan and Clapper are sort of like hardened Democrats. When really these are career intelligence guys.
Yeah, you bet.
But in any case, what is your perspective on how what seemed like the conventions of politics for most of the last 20 years have just been kind of flipped around in the last couple of years?
So let me give you one example that I actually use in the book. And it's the core of the book and pretty much everything we've talked about mm-hmm. so far, Josh, has been about we're living in a post-truth world in which data and information is less relevant to decision-making than emotion, preference, feeling, loyalty, tribe, grievance, and so on. And that's the big shift. And so the high friction points of the current administration, which I think embraces and exploits and worsens that post-truth drift inside our political culture, the high friction points of that administration then have been with intelligence, law enforcement, the courts, science, scholarship, and journalism.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Because, they can all be imperfect. They can all be wrong. They can occasionally even be corrupt.
Right.
But at their core, their only safe haven is the pursuit of truth.
Right.
And if they don't pursue truth, they die over a period of time.
Right.
All right? Now, the interesting thing, and back to your original question about strange alignments, mm-hmm. all right, is that as I'm making a symbol here in the ether between us, I'm holding up my fingers, intelligence, law enforcement, and so on, all right? And we're all bound together right now because we believe our self-identity is truth tellers.
Mm-hmm.
But, most of my life experience is that those other people didn't include me in their group.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
In journalism and scholarship.
Well, that was certainly the late Bush administration.
Exactly. And they were shooting at us metaphorically.
Right.
Because of how we acquired information.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That conversation is totally muted now. And those other communities, scholarship and journalism and so on, are embracing us because we're information people mm-hmm. like them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we get beyond the current dynamics.
Right.
All right. I think they'll get back to shooting at us again.
Right. Well, there's some natural state versus outside the state.
Exactly.
And stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But back to your mm-hmm. premise, strange alignments. I haven't had anybody make a run at me in the last several years. In one instance I can think of about renditions, detentions, interrogations, targeted killings, mm-hmm. electronic surveillance. All right. Not a one. All right. I've actually been embraced by people who used to do that routinely
mm-hmm.
Because my profession, my tribe, my discipline is holding its ground based on we're database people like you are, which is a completely different alignment
among these
professions than we've seen for the rest of my professional life.
It's interesting because, there are a lot of our listeners who are going to be saying right now on as they're listening, like, Josh, what about warrantless surveillance? Yeah. You're really blowing it here. We know about that, and it's not what I'm interested in talking about now, and I'll get grief for that, and that's fine. But it is, you know, because it's funny, because when, I mean, obviously, the phrase deep state is what I at least think of originally about Turk, you know, kind of the
Turkey,
the
Pakistan,
Turkish,
maybe.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And obviously, it is sort of wild and crazy for the U.S., but there is a certain truth in the sense of there is a whole part of the state that continues on even after there's a new president.
That's
and
right.
sort of like, so just because, and I think this is at some level what our current president has had such a hard time with, I think in his mind, like, I won. So you got to support me now.
Right.
And that, it doesn't work that way, or at least hopefully
it does not work that way.
And yeah,
so I mean, if I would get that question on the sidewalk out here, I said, so let me get this right. You want the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the head of the Air Force, the head of the FBI to change every time we have an election in this country? I mean, are you really asking for? I mean, when you put it that way,
right.
I think the answer is that's not what I'm saying.
Right, right, right.
And so you do get this continuity. All right, and so now I need to be very fair here. All right, well, people in my old job owe some loyalty to this president. Mm-hmm. You know, we know how to count. We know how the Electoral College works. He's the legitimate president of the
right.
United States. His policies, his priorities deserve to be our policies, our priorities. He learns in different ways from his predecessors. We change. He doesn't. All right? We accommodate the president. But we also have other things beyond loyalty to the president. All right? And for the intelligence world, it's what it is we do for a living. It's fact-based analysis, trying to create the left and right-hand boundaries of logical policy discussion.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And so the great danger, and this is how I get off stage in the book, is that although we must accommodate to every president, we cannot accommodate so far to any particular president that we undercut our legitimacy to ourselves, to the broader population, or undercut our legitimacy to the guy who's going to be president next.
Right.
All right.
Right.
And so what you see now are a president who's put the word premium doesn't even seem to be sufficient, but he's put a premium on personal loyalty to him at the expense of any other consideration. So you've got Jeff Sessions, with whom I disagree on a lot of things, but who never treated me with anything other than Southern gentlemanliness mm-hmm. and respect when, you know, he was in the Senate. You have Jeff Sessions saying, no, and everyone agrees, he has to recuse himself. The president rejects that calculation. He doesn't try to recalculate it. He just simply says, that's not a real consideration. You have to be loyal to me. And we've never experienced that before.
So here's the kind of question I've wanted to kind of build towards. One of the, as we all know, this investigation has been going on for a year and a half now, I guess even maybe 2 years if you go back to stuff that was happening very behind the scenes during the election. There's part of this that is, you know, there's those phone calls Mike Flynn made to the Russian ambassador kind of hold them back when President Obama was doing these punitive sanctions. And there were a lot of things happening in that kind of interregnum right there. And one of the things that has always struck me is it's clear that the politicals in the Obama administration, but also the people who may be appointees, but again, the Brennans and Clappers and Comeys, are wanting to do their duty, and there's a handoff of power, but also kind of they don't really know quite what's happening or who Trump is in the big sense. And that is just kind of fascinating to me. And about that really gets into what are our proper loyalties? Our loyalties, I mean, whatever we can say, Trump was elected president.
Right.
So that
right.
our primary loyalty is that. But a lot of weird stuff happened during the election. And so here's my question. What do you think put yourself in, I'm the outgoing NSA director, his name escapes me.
Mike Rogers.
When President Trump comes into office with, I would think, some pretty legitimate questions, at least, about what was going on during the election and all these kind of, you know, strange communications and so forth. You know, whether that we don't know, you know, the whole collusion question, that's right. we're still kind of figuring right. that out. But if you are the NSA director or the FBI director, where the kind of, you know, the rubber really hit the road, yeah. You have your loyalty to the Constitution, which means president is your boss. But who's the president working for?
Constitution's a bigger concept than just loyalty to the president.
Exactly. So what do you think those guys, and here I mean guys, who were heading the intelligence community, the national security apparatus, what do you think they were thinking or should have been thinking when President Trump became president, and now this person who, there's some open questions about who he was working with during the election, is now president?
Yeah, so I'm not aware, all right, of the folks, Jim Clapper and Mike Rogers and Jim Comey and others. I'm not aware of them, and I've never heard them say it, challenging the legitimacy of the president, all right?
Right.
Now, I do know that the story they were trying to tell the president was being used by others to challenge the legitimacy of the president.
Right.
And that poisoned their conversation with the president.
Right.
Because
right.
he couldn't
right.
dissociate
yep.
the two realities. So that's one. All right. But there's a lot of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the classic is, and now this is a little bit after the president's in the chair, in March, on a Saturday morning from Mar-a-Lago, he tweets out that Obama wiretapped Trump Tower, all right? And so what do you do now if you're the FBI director, the director of NSA, the director of National Intelligence? Well, I mean, what they did, and I tell the story in the book to kind of suggest we're in uncharted territory here. You had Mike Rogers and Jim Comey in open session in front of the House Intelligence Committee simply say that is not so. Now, they didn't say the president was a liar, but they said the president was a liar.
Right.
Okay? And they have to.
In the least confrontational way, but
right.
you say what
but
the facts are.
But they have to, have to go say that. There are other instances that I only touch upon lightly in the book because I didn't get into the inside baseball story myself. But it's public knowledge that the president calls these guys up and asks them to go public, saying there's no evidence of this and that. And they refuse.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
No, we can't. We can't do that
right.
and continue to be who we are. And so there's certainly loyalty to the president and the constitutional process, but there's the broader constitution. And then, you know, it's not an unfair consideration as to the health of the organization you lead. All right? You can't put the organization in a place where it's viewed to be a political arm of one particular party or individual. You've got to try to do your best to keep it above that. And I think by and large, they did okay
mm-hmm.
in very unusual circumstances. I will admit, and I try to be as sympathetic as possible to Jim Comey in terms of the investigation of the Secretary of State. You know, my sense is going out there twice, once was a bad idea, twice was worse.
Yeah.
And it would have been better had he done the right number there was zero,
mm-hmm.
not one
mm-hmm.
or two, not
right.
one or two. But I'm very understanding for Jim. You know, there's nothing in the FBI director's handbook that says when you're investigating a major political,
or when you're investigating both.
Right. Yeah. and so he did what he did.
Right.
All right. But I think it was well intentioned, but maybe not the right course of action.
So. Final question. The president is out there. We know the president fired James Comey. We know he tried to fire Bob Mueller and was his staff kind of just
waved
pushed
off.
Him back.
Again, people who have broader loyalties than just to the person of the president.
Right. And even I'm not a fan of Jeff Sessions at all. And yet he has not. I mean, he got pretty close with helping. Both of them did with writing that memo to justify
right.
firing James
right.
Comey,
right.
and yet they have not fundamentally turned the Justice Department over to President Trump. So he's done these things. He has tried to muscle Jeff Sessions. He has slandered every law enforcement and intelligence agency really in the country, even though he is the executive and runs them, right, at least in a constitutional sense, and just made up all these kind of crazy stories about witch hunts and stuff like that. Why do you think he's doing that?
So, number one, we're back to the post-truth era in which if I can make it trending or I can make it popular, it's true.
Right.
And so even though they aren't corrupt, even though there probably wasn't any illicit unmasking of U.S. identities, even though the FISA application probably met every possible – I mean, I know something about these things.
Yep.
They look really normal to me, all right? But we've made them criminal acts, all right, in the dialogue that's emanating from – the monologue emanating from the president. I think that's untrue, but I do think he wants to delegitimize those who – would oppose him, right? Those from whom he cannot get that absolute commitment of loyalty. So to answer your question specifically, I think this is preemptive delegitimization of Mueller's investigation so that he can fight it at the political level, which is, from his personal point of view, the only place it will be fought.
Now, doesn't that, you know, in a criminal trial, we're not supposed to draw these inferences. Doesn't this reality suggest there's something to
again at the political
that
level?
He
at
wants
a,
to hide.
I'm a citizen who has the right to observe this and form a judgment. I mean, it doesn't show a great deal of confidence as to where this thing is going.
All right, so I
get that.
Yeah.
Let me add another thought though. I can't imagine what it's like working in the White House right now. I've worked in the White House. All right, it's full time day work in normal circumstances, and I mean full-time day, 12, 14, 15 hours. And now these people go to work. They've got an unstable projection of what American policy is because David Ignatius has a wonderful phrase, they must respond to the iron whim of the Oval Office.
Okay. I hadn't heard that. That's good.
Very good. So they've got that. They've got the Russian investigation. They've got the president's assault on institutions they work with routinely in order to get the job done on behalf of the president.
Right.
And there appears to be a fair amount of political infighting within the White House itself. And none of that ends, Josh, until Bob Mueller's done.
Right.
All right?
Right.
And so my great hope is he is able to do a thorough investigation, but he gets his conclusions out there as clearly and as quickly as possible because the cloud hanging over American governance now is really really damaging to our ability to govern ourselves.
Right.
And that's not an accusation against Bob Mueller. It's just a reality that until he's done, this isn't done, and we're going to be in this state of turmoil because the president cannot find it within himself to just let it ride.
Right.
I mean, which other presidents have.
Right. I mean, Obama's sort of the exception that there was no big investigation.
Right.
I mean, I give President Obama a lot of credit on this. He, these things do kind of start from the top, right?
Yeah. Oh, you set the tone.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Exactly
Clinton
right.
Clinton had one. There was obviously Reagan had one. The President Bush you served had one with the Scooter Libby stuff, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and he kept hands off and rejected his vice president's request for clemency.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, listen, General Mike Hayden, the book is The Assault on Intelligence. It's been out for 4 or 5 weeks.
Yep.
And I have read it. I found it very – the part that I have been most interested in, again, are the parts about – this issue of what we're trying to, cyber versus information, and that part I found fascinating. So I recommend it, and thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you very much, Josh. Thank you.
Absolutely. Now, don't forget, before as we're finishing up here, that the Josh Marshall Podcast is sponsored by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. Get 20% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM or order Grady's on amazon.com for next day delivery. All right, we will talk to you next week.